Pushkin. The furthest away I've ever been from home was when I went to Japan. A popular travel website that helps people temporarily rent out their homes asked me to make a podcast pilot about the positive experiences people had using their service. Since I needed the money and Not Lost wasn't off the ground yet, I agreed. I told my friend Lars about it over drinks one night, and he flagged a potential problem. The thing is, the only stories people really want to hear about from a company like that is what went wrong. The horror stories, you know? The guest that left the door unlocked and a bear wandered in. The homeowner who set up a secret camera. The renter who was looking for Q-tips and found a box of nail clippings. That last example seemed a little too specific, but I was too scared to ask if he was making it up. Of course, the company didn't want to highlight horror stories. Instead, the list of suggestions they sent was filled with charming anecdotes about how their service had enhanced people's lives. One was about an adopted woman who rented a place in another state that turned out to be the home of her biological sister. Heartlifting? Sure, but also a bit like the beginning of an A24 horror film. And that's how I found myself on a business class flight to Japan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome aboard.
If I was going to get paid to tell happy stories, I might as well make the most of it and book a ticket for the most interesting destination on their list of ideas. First stop was Tokyo, but my ultimate destination was Nagoya, the fourth most populous city in Japan. The story I was tracking down came from a man named Kenzo. Kenzo was a self-described businessman who was raised in Nagoya. His elderly parents were struggling financially when he heard about the company's service. Years ago, his parents had bought an old farmhouse in the country where, allegedly, samurai once trained. Now, the family rented out the house on the company's website, and Kenzo's mother had become a thriving entrepreneur, like an elderly Japanese Gwyneth Paltrow or a pre-prison Martha Stewart. Upon arriving in Nagoya, I met up with Aiko, a local journalist who I'd arranged to have translate for me. As we wandered around the city, I felt a kinship with the place. As a native of Philadelphia, a gritty, second-tier industrial city kind of spoke to me on some level. We stopped for lunch and had chicken cutlets drenched in Nagoya's preferred ingredient, a red soybean paste made of hacha miso, bonito stock, and sugar. Its oozy, salty tang reminded me of Philly's preferred ingredient, Cheese Whiz. After lunch, we met up with Kenzo, a tall, youthful 51-year-old wearing a brand new putty-colored winter vest, stylish sweatpants, and Gucci sneakers. "They sent you here from New York?" he said, quizzically. I said yes. A half smile crossed his face. Then he disarmed the alarm in his Audi, and we piled in. The tidy gray buildings of industrial Nagoya gave way to the earth-colored hills covered with cedar trees and dotted with rice paddies. After driving for an hour, we pulled into a tiny village, 10 buildings in a valley. We drove up to the biggest house in town. Its silhouette, classically Japanese, big broad walls with dark swooping roofs of Japanese tile. It was an impressive space. But immediately, I noticed something was amiss. The doorways to the house were pretty narrow. I'm not sure an average American could walk straight through, let alone a big samurai wearing armor and a katana. A commotion came from a small building adjacent to the farmhouse, which looked to be a servant's quarters. Kenzo exhaled deeply and asked us to stay put as he rushed away. Aiko and I walked around the grounds and saw, incongruously, a modern patio with the barbecue and two Adirondack chairs. A few minutes later, Kenzo emerged, holding the arm of an elderly woman wearing a cleaner's onesie with a handkerchief in her hair. There was a smudge on her face, along with a look of both defeat and defiance. "Brendan, this is my mother, Mizuko." I said hello and bowed slightly and presented her with a little box of chocolates I'd picked up in Nagoya after Aiko told me visitors in Japan were expected to bring gifts. Mizuko lightly nodded her head in my direction and avoided looking at the gift. Kenzo took it from me. Ah, dark chocolate, my favorite. Mizuko walked away, muttering something in Japanese. What did she say? I asked Aiko. Time for me to make your damn lunch, Aiko said, giggling. Come, let me give you a tour of the property, said Kenzo. His gold watch flashed in the sun as he pointed out the wired fence they'd put up to keep out wild boars. And he was careful not to get his Gucci sneakers muddy near the chicken coop. He told me about how, as an only son, he was obligated to take care of his parents. And even though he was successful and able to do it, he felt that just giving money to his parents depressed his mother, that she had wanted to contribute in some way, but entering the workforce now, after being out of it for so long, would be difficult for her. Thanks to the new company, the company that had sent me business class from NYC to record this conversation, his mother's depression, according to Kenzo, had lifted. My mother says I saved her life, Kenzo said, pushing his highlighted hair to the side of his forehead. Your company saved her life. I winced. It was a moving story, but a little on the nose. It reminded me of the countless interviews I've done with actors where their publicist is in the room, one talking point after another. I would usually not use those interviews for their lack of honesty, but in the world of SponCon, that's sponsored content for the morally pure among you, we're all actors parroting out talking points. With a few edits, this chat with Kenzo would make for a great scene. After a tour of the grounds, we sat for lunch on pillows around a long, low, wide table. Mizuko brought out bowls and sloshed miso soup into them with a wooden ladle. When she served Kenzo, it splashed up and left a dot on his putty puffy vest. He muttered under his breath. Mizuko said something back, and then they both raised their voices and quickly moved to the kitchen, where I could hear them continue bickering. While they were out of earshot, Aiko told me that she spoke with Mizuko while Kenzo was giving me a tour. I think things are a little different than we thought, she said. Mizuko told Aiko that she missed living in Nagoya, and that the only reason she was at the samurai house was because Kenzo pressed her to move back here and take care of the house so he could make money renting it. Meanwhile, Kenzo was living the bachelor life back at the family apartment in Nagoya. So maybe this would be a horror story after all. Or at least a dark A24-style family drama. Kenzo returned, apologized for his absence, and announced he needed to head back to Nagoya. Aiko and I were to spend the night at Samurai House, and he'd be back to pick us up late the next morning. The next day, I woke up early and asked Aiko to interpret for me as I recorded an interview with Mizuko. Over a cup of tea, Mizuko told me about how her husband had found this old farmhouse decades ago on a road trip to get some fresh air. Kenzo was their only child. While Mizuko's husband painstakingly restored the home, Kenzo would pass summers pretending he was a samurai playing in the countryside. After graduating high school, Kenzo went to get an MBA in the United States and returned and worked for a company in Tokyo, but things went poorly, and one day he returned home to Nagoya and moved back in with them. He seemed depressed. And there he lived, for a while, without working. And then he learned about the website that allowed people to temporarily rent their homes for money. He told Mizuko and her husband that they had to do it. Besides, it was too cramped with all three of them in the city. And so, since he was her only son, she obeyed him. It was a lot of work for an old lady, and she was growing exhausted. But she supposed it was worth it to support her son. After our chat, I took one more walk around the grounds to record some ambient sounds. As I was about to hit record, I clicked back to my recording of Kenzo the day before and listened as he talked about all the good he had done for his family. I then stopped the recorder. I rewound it to the beginning again and recorded over it. Now, instead of him talking about how grateful his mother was for him and the company, it was all birdsong and trees rustling in the distance. When I got back to New York, I told the company about the unfortunate incident about losing the tape of Kenzo's story. But I also told them not to worry. I had a solution. Instead of a story about a mother converted into an entrepreneur, I would tell the story of a mother who loved her son so much, she did all she could to help him. And that's what I did. Not really sure what the company made of it. They didn't provide a lot of feedback, and as far as I know, the story has never seen the light of day. I did get paid, though. When I received my check, I took my friend Lars out for drinks again, and I told him about how the story I'd been sent to get turned out to be different once I was there. I told him about Mizuko and how I'd taped over my conversation with Kenzo, and I told him that someone should open a lunch truck that makes cheesesteaks with hacho miso paste. Lars sipped his beer. Yeah, but the story about how you had to override the story, that's the best story of them all. You should do stuff like that on your show when you finally get one. And so, that's what I did. I'm Brendan Francis Newnham, everybody, and this is Not Lost Chat, my series of conversations with fellow travelers. On today's episode, we speak to a writer who does the opposite of parachute into a place to tell a preconceived story. For his latest book, The Serpent Coiled in Naples, poet and travel writer Marius Khodorkovsky lived in Italy's City of the Sun and then shares what he learned. And after that, TV writer, essayist, and comedian Jessie Klein tells us about her preferred mode of visiting places.
I do love to sit near the ocean and drink.
And that makes her perfectly qualified to help me help you with your travel questions. So stick around, but first, we need to keep the lights on at Pushkin.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
My first guest today is Marius Khodorkovsky. He is a poet, essayist, travel writer, and now, after reading him and researching him, my role model. And after you hear him, I hope you'll understand why. Marius was born in Canada to an English mother and Polish father. He then moved to London, where he wrote and made a living in the rare book trade. But he first came on the scene as a poet. His first collection of poems won the Cheltenham Prize, which is an honor he shares with such luminaries as Kazuo Ishiguro and Hilary Mantel. Pretty nice company. And his first prose works were travel writings, primarily on Syria, which is a country he really came to love after spending time there. Of late, Marius has developed a new geographic paramour, Naples. Primarily, he focuses on the people that live there, the merchants, the musicians, the landlords, and he gets to know them by living there. He embeds himself into these communities and immerses himself in research. His most recent book is called The Serpent Coiled in Naples, and The New Yorker put it on their list of best nonfiction books of 2022, which could be part of the reason it was really hard to find. I looked at The Strand in Manhattan. I looked at Powell's in Portland and Elliott Bay and Seattle. No dice. Finally was able to finagle a copy. Anyway, I was very excited to finally dive into it. He is such a wonderful guide. And that's what I asked him to do when we started our conversation. I asked him to take me and you, listeners, on an imaginary tour of his Naples.
Right. Well, if we're walking, I think we would go up from the Bay of Naples, up the Via Roma, and towards Spacca Napoli, which is the old bit of town. And I usually stay in an area called Forcella. You go from Spacca Napoli, you cross the Via Duomo, and you're in the crime zone. Even when I talk to Neapolitans and they ask me where I'm staying, they can't believe it, Forcella. It's real. I like the people. I have a wonderful landlady called Melania, who has just, if you want a picture where we are, yes? We're getting,
yeah.
Where I'm leading you to is to Melania's ankle, upon which she has a serpent tattooed. Now, that's entirely coincidental. She didn't put the serpent there in order to fit the theme of my book. Melania lives in this rather rickety apartment block, which is held together with wooden beams and has been that way for decades, ever since the earthquake of 1980. So the building could topple at any time, I suppose, but then so could the whole of Naples.
It's complex, and you do such a marvelous job bringing your reader into the maelstrom of history and ideas and characters. The serpentine that's on the foot, also, the title of your book came before you encountered her, it seems, the Serpentine of Naples.
It did.
The quote, I believe, is, never fear Rome, the serpentine lies coiled in Naples.
Yes. My temera Roma il serpente se ne sta atrocellato a Napoli. Don't fear Rome, the serpent lies coiled in Naples. As soon as I read that, and even without knowing exactly what it meant, there was my title, The Serpent Coiled in Naples. I've never done that before. I've never gone into a situation or to a place with a ready-made title, but it was a gift, as it were.
Yeah. And you spend the book unpacking that title,
mm-hmm.
but there's another quote. If you open all the doors of Naples, Rome disappears. To
yes.
situate what Naples means in the mindset of Italians, and I would broaden it to say Europeans, talk about that crosstown rivalry and what Naples represents.
I mean, there is, of course, a constant rivalry between the north and south of Italy. And, of course, you see this exemplified, particularly at football games. You know, they're really out to kill each other. But there is something else which distinguishes Naples from any other big city in Italy, which is, I think, hugely important. If you go to Venice, if you go to Florence, you go to Rome, the old centers of those places have now been given over to tourism, restaurants, whatever else. Whereas in Naples, you're still looking at a center which is occupied by the original people. And that makes it unique. I had this beautifully illustrated for me a few years ago when a lady showed me a stretch of pavement and she said, take a look at this groove in the stone. You know, a simple shallow groove, and she said, and follow it, and it led to a fishmonger. And she said that groove is centuries old, and as you'll see, the fishmonger is still here. Now, that was one of the most invaluable lessons I had about Naples.
Right. That's such a striking moment. There's water that's been dripping from this fishmonger's cart and shop for centuries, which caused that groove. You know, it also reminds me, at one point you write, blood, tears, and semen have seeped into and oozed from every crack of this old town center, which I think does get across the kind of dankness and richness of these impoverished quarters of Naples. To pick one of those, you talk a lot about blood in this book. It's ever present. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, yes. Blood. Well, when I wrote that line, I was thinking in particular of the great composer Gesualdo, who discovered that his wife was having an affair and came home late one night, caught them at it, and stabbed both of them to death and had their bodies dragged out onto the pavement, where they lay for about a week. But of course, that's just one form of blood.
There's also the gangs.
Indeed. There is one zone in the north of a part of Naples called Scampia. The police don't go into that zone. It's one of the most, well, it is the most violent area in the whole of Europe. You know, you can go out on the street and never be sure whether you're looking at a regular citizen or a killer. And of course, it's very sad. They say that if you go into any cafe and you buy an espresso, a percentage of the price of that espresso will finally end up in the Camorra's pockets. There are also all kinds of other contradictions in that in recent years, Naples has become a much safer place to visit. Why is that? Because the Camorra have put out the message to leave the tourists alone. Why have they done that? Because they own a good bit of the tourist industry. So they would like it to be a safe place for tourists. You know. And I've never in my time there experienced any trouble. That said, all of that is now being threatened. Naples is becoming more and more of a popular tourist destination, and there is gentrification moving even into Forcella, the tough zone where I stay. And so it's always with a certain amount of hesitation that I recommend places that I love. You know, tourism is, in so many ways, the enemy of all that one loves about a place.
Yes.
And the 17th century churchman and historian Thomas Fuller said that travel makes a wise man better, but a fool worse. And unfortunately, you see more fools than wise men on the streets.
You know, you're putting your finger on, I think, something in a much smaller way I've struggled with, but the burden, for lack of a better word, of a travel writer, which is this compulsion to share.
Yes.
To really take an X-ray on a place and pass that information along. And yet, the closer you get to your subject, the more you want to protect it.
Yes.
And so, how do you reconcile that tension? What makes you decide to go forward?
I haven't yet reconciled it. I don't know if I ever will. You know, in the final chapter of my book, I write about going to a particular festa on the slopes of Vesuvius. And it took me months to get onto that. And it was the most wonderful experience for me. But in writing about it, my deepest fear is that I've exposed it.
Yes.
And I'm thinking to myself, you know, suppose one day a tourist bus goes up that slope and tries to join in with the festa.
Yeah.
I have to say, I would feel incredibly guilty.
Hmm. But you still wrote it.
I still wrote it.
You still.
That's the contradiction you're talking about, and it's the one I have not yet resolved myself. And I wonder if I ever will. Writing is my passion. And, you know, falling in love with a place is, in a sense, a kind of romance. And one wants to be true to what one sees.
You cite at one point an old joke. Mm. Someone's on a train and they ask the conductor, when do we arrive in Naples? And he said, hold up your wrist to your eye, look at your watch, and look at the minute hand. And when your watch disappears, you're in Naples.
Yeah, I'll let that fall on your head, not mine. You've got to walk down through the streets of New York City.
I mean, they have to go through some pretty tough neighborhoods to get to me.
Right. Yeah.
That might give Naples a run for his money. Well, it's interesting. The preamble, when you're described as a poet, an essayist, and a travel writer. And I don't really see you as a travel writer in that you've written about Naples. Mm. Previously, you've written books about Syria, Damascus, and that's another place you're talking about love that it seems you fell in love with, mm-hmm. and you really steep yourself and into these cultures, right? Both intellectually as well as physically.
Yes.
And so, yeah, do you see any distinction between between yourself and what's considered a travel writer?
I think it's fantastic that you raised this question because I think I constantly disqualify myself as a travel writer. The reason I'm called that occasionally is so they know where to put me in the bookshops. And I think the main reason for that being that I don't travel through places so much as I do through the lives of people.
Mm.
And my thinking is that if you get close to someone, that sooner or later, that person will reflect his or her surroundings. I enjoy people. I enjoy their stories. And what their stories tell me is really about the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems you do consult with both the living and the dead. So who helps you more, the living or the dead, when you're kind of trying to figure out a place?
Naples, like nowhere else I've been, the dead are always with you. They're with the Neapolitans. I had somebody criticize me for saying, oh, you don't talk correctly about the dead. And I said, look, it's not me. It's them. You know, it's Neapolitans addressing the dead and the dead addressing them. When Naples won the World Cup with the great Maradona, people rushed to the cemetery to tell the dead, you've no idea what you missed. And you know, the whole belief system with the skull of cults, which is probably the reason why I went there, is that there is this sort of communication, you know, this flow between the living and the dead, such that there is no barrier left between them.
Yeah, you write of going into, for example, the volcanic quarries underneath Naples.
That's right.
And there's packed with skulls.
That's right.
And some of them are shiny, burnished, almost like a polished shoe, mm-hmm. because they're touched so often.
Yes.
For good luck.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And of course, the skull cult there is rather different than that which you will find in Mexico. You adopt a skull, you take care of it, keep it clean, dust it off, you know, now and then. Mm. The spirit possessor of that skull will come to you in dreams.
Mm.
And you can ask questions. But, you know, the Neapolitans being Neapolitan, they tend to ask for the lottery ticket numbers. Or they used to. They used to.
At one point you say, any place one chooses to map is unmappable. And mm-hmm. so I ask you, why map it? Why take a crack at this?
Well, I'm always cautious when it comes to talking about, let's say, inner journeys.
You're half British.
Yeah, I always felt that's a load of nonsense myself. Mm. You know, one goes to learn, one goes to see, but in terms of that great revolution in the soul that's supposed to take place, I mean, have you ever heard of anything so vain? I mean, it's awful. And I think that very notion has contaminated a lot of travel literature.
Mm.
And I always tell people, you know, go to a place with modesty and curiosity, but don't go in the expectation of altering the state of your soul. You know, respect and intelligence, that's the way to approach any place. And, of course, in that respect, I've always maintained that the puffballs of peace are sometimes worse than the missiles of war. Tourism is the soft weapon which is destroying so many places.
Mm.
I was really shocked when I went to Amalfi for the first time, where every square inch of the center of Amalfi is given over to tourism, whether it's postcards, ice creams, or souvenir shops. I just found it incredibly depressing that you have this beautiful city in the middle of the most beautiful landscape, and yet it's been completely ruined. The very reason that people went there in the first place was to see the magic. The magic is long gone.
I think that might be a good place to end. I'm going to encourage you never to listen to my podcast if you don't like personal journeys blended with your travel. But I think you'll find that my curiosity and interest in true local folks and what they have to say is at the heart of my project.
Great.
Thank you for taking the time to chat with me this evening.
My great pleasure. My great pleasure.
Marius Kaczachowski. His latest book is called The Serpent Coiled in Naples, and I encourage you to check it out. We hardly scratched its surface here. It's a really, really rich book. And honestly, I was hoping that Marius and I would become best friends forever after our conversation, but I kind of have a feeling after he hears me navel-gazing in front of Leonard Cohen's house in Montreal, he'll want nothing to do with me. That's okay. Maybe I'll just stare in front of Marius' house in London some point in the future. But fortunately for me, after the break, I'm going to be joined by another navel-gazy writer, Jessie Klein. She's also a comedian, and I have a feeling she's going to like my style.
That is nice. A man with a sports coat with that inner pass, that is kind of a hot moment.
Not lost. We'll be right back.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at tmobile.com/now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
All right, we are back here at Not Lost Chat. I am coming to you today from Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn, and I've been commuting more and more here to Manhattan to help make this show. And I've noticed that people are walking slower, like maybe half a mile per hour slower. And that might not seem like much, but it does make a difference when you are walking in the streets every day and have been walking these streets for years. It's an interesting shift. You can sense it when you're on the stairwell, when you're moving around town. And whether it's related to like post-COVID lockdown disorientation or something else, I don't know. I mean, actually, I do know. Everyone is staring at their phones. But anyway, whatever the reason, it really adds to this feeling I've had for the past few months that I don't remember really how to behave around people like I did before COVID. And arguably, I didn't even really know how to behave around them then. So to help me refresh my memory and help other folks who might be in the same boat, I've decided to invite a world-savvy guest each week to help answer questions about moving and traveling through the world. And this week, I'm joined by the TV writer, essayist, and comedian Jessie Klein. She is probably best known for her work on the show Inside Amy Schumer, but she's also written for a ton of other shows, like Transparent. She's a consulting producer on the Netflix show Big Mouth, and she writes books too. Her most recent book is called I'll Show Myself Out, Essays on Midlife and Motherhood. And with so much going on in her life, I asked if she even has time to travel.
I think an illusion has been created because I'm actually not...
You're unemployed?
I currently am a little bit unemployed, but I'm not that prolific. I think because of the pandemic, certain things got slowed down that would have like kind of come out along various different years. And then because of COVID, have you heard of it? It was this virus.
Yeah, we heard about it in New York.
Yeah. Did you get it there? Anyways, a bunch of things came out at once, and it made it seem like, oh, who's this girl who's just endlessly working? But all of these things took like 5 years of development. And anyways, I don't take vacations.
Well, that was the other.
It's not really because I'm working that hard.
It strikes me that you wouldn't be someone who takes a vacation with like a coconut with a straw in it kind of vacation, because I'm not that type of person either.
Well, I do think about like, what's my ideal vacation? I do love to sit near the ocean and drink.
Okay.
Like, I don't go in it a ton because sharks. But to be near it, looking at it, and drinking like a cold, a Sancerre, I don't know, something.
Oh,
if it's in a coconut, sure, as long as it's booze. But right. I feel like I could only do that for so many days. I do like walking through a beautiful city.
Okay.
I am craving right now some kind of maybe a forest experience.
Okay. Forest bath or just forest walk or drink near
no,
a forest?
I guess, I think at this point in life, now just if you're in a forest, you're taking a forest bath. And if you're hearing sounds, you're in a sound bath.
Okay. It's just bathing.
I don't know. I think that's just the terminology now. What separates walking through a forest from a forest bath?
I think you pay someone named after a noun $180 to take a forest bath.
To take a forest bath.
Yeah, and it involves incense.
Willow.
And something. Yeah,
Willow's
exactly.
Going to take me on my forest bath.
Exactly.
Okay, that's helpful.
So when I was preparing to chat with you, I was reading some interviews you did when your book came out about half a year ago now.
Yes.
And in one of them, you talked about Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Eat, Pray, Love.
Yes.
And you said that you've read it a ton of times.
I have.
And, I mean, I've interviewed Elizabeth Gilbert a couple of times. She's brilliant. I think she's wonderful.
So brilliant.
But there are only so many books in the world. Why would you want to read that one more than once?
That's a really good question. I mean, especially when that book came out, I think I was like exactly the strike zone for it. And
yeah.
Just covers, I think, a lot of human experience in a lovely, smart way. I know there was kind of a little bit of a backlash to that book because I think for reasons that were unrelated to the book or to Elizabeth Gilbert, it became a little bit labeled like with sort of a basic bitch brush. But I don't think that's really super fair to it.
Having read your earlier book of essays, being familiar with your work with Amy Schumer and other things, you don't strike me as someone who would want to go to Bali and kind of like find yourself and get like henna tattoos. But maybe I'm wrong.
Definitely not into the henna tattoo. You know, with travel, the day there's a teleporter, I'll go most places. But I am at my core a little lazy. So a really, really long flight really intimidates me. Yeah. It's so dumb. Why miss out on beautiful things in the world because you don't want to go to the airport and be on a plane that long? It's dumb.
So it's not the basic bitch stuff that makes you anxious about it. It's not the being in the back of a moped. That stuff, totally okay. It's just the actual trip.
I get intimidated by the trip. I'm actually, especially as I creep towards getting older and older and older and older, I'm very into the woo-woo finding yourself stuff. I would absolutely do that.
Have you read the book called Yoga by Emmanuel Carrère? It's like a...
No.
It was a hot book. It's what people are reading in New York in the subway.
Oh, okay. Please.
Just help you.
Please.
Yeah.
Oh.
Just thought I'd
God,
let you
that's
know.
One
no.
of the things I miss about New York is knowing what people... Like,
yeah.
You really are like, what should I read? And you look around and you're like, this is what people are reading. What's that rat reading? What's Pizza Rat looking at?
What's Pizza Rat dragging?
Is Pizza
yoga
Rat reading yoga? Yoga Rat.
Anyway, part of it is a guy who goes to this meditation resort. He's been doing those things for years. And he has to be silent for 10 days.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Silent is a no for me. I wouldn't do that. And I also, I'm realizing, like, I want to caveat finding myself. I will not be quiet. And I won't, and I won't meditate.
Okay. So you are obviously a jet setter. You love to be in a plane. You know,
well,
you'll hop
yeah.
at the drop of a hat. You will cash in your travel points and go somewhere.
Yeah.
So you're perfectly qualified to help some of my listeners with their etiquette questions.
I would love to help
all
if
right.
I can.
This first one comes from Anna from Wyoming. She writes, "This is because I've watched so many Real Housewives strips. In a big group, how do you assign rooms in a vacation house? Who gets the smallest room? This is the cause of a lot of stress with big group trips where there's a mix of singles and couples, also on bachelorette weekends."
Ooh, that's a really, really good question. That would stress me out. I'm picky as hell. And I think at this point, I would probably be one of the people creating the problems. But
I agree with you. I would scope the entire joint. I would do some calculus in my head and try to get the best room possible without feeling like a jerk.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it feels like if there's dedicated organizer to the trip, I would say, like, maybe you're just like, I'm going to assign those rooms. Everyone knows in advance, so there's not that scramble.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think having a leader, like, I'm someone who's pretty picky, but if I know I'm in good hands, as long as it's been thought about, I could be in a less than excellent room. Because I'm like, some justice has been administered here. There's been some thought to it. I don't like a free-for-all because I feel guilty because I will win, but then I won't enjoy myself. Or I'll go the other direction and take the worst room as like some martyr. I'll be my mother and my father, basically.
Yeah.
And that doesn't feel good.
A free-for-all is so anxiety-inducing.
So, Anna, I don't know if we answered. Find a strong organizer and secretly lobby that organizer on the side.
Yes.
Okay. We have another question from Nicole. Nicole from New Jersey. Due to planes no longer guaranteeing you to sit together unless you pay, do you agree to give up your prepaid seat so that a parent can sit with their child?
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
That's just karma points. You're now, will I do it for just like a healthy couple? No. No. No.
No.
Like a healthy, thriving couple? Like two people who want to canoodle the whole flight long. Absolutely
no.
not. But for a parent and a kid, that's like you gotta.
Yeah. I'm with you on this. As someone who doesn't have a kid, I still think that's a pretty mean, curmudgeonly thing to do to not give up your seat. I will say, though, now any parent listening will not have to prepay because they're just going to assume people will just give them their seat.
Can I say on the flip side of all of this, if you are the parent who was not able to get your seats together and someone is doing this kindness for you, and you are showing up at that airport knowing you're going to have to ask this, you better have some kind of a gift card, a, I'm serious, like have a thing, like have something to offer as a thank you because, yeah, the presumptuousness of it, I think you got to have some kind of little gift card in your pocket for the person.
At least make the effort and then the person should not accept it in a way. But you should do the little dance of like, I'd like to.
Yeah. It's not fair, but it's right.
So the peanut gallery, I shared this with the peanut gallery for asking this question, and one parent said, I love the idea of dropping my kid off with a stranger. Good luck. Like, if they won't give up their seat, good luck. Like, have fun with my five-year-old.
Yeah, have at it.
Yeah, have at it, buddy.
They're going to be screaming and freaking. Fine.
You're going to have smashed goldfish falling out of your clothes. Okay. Yeah. This question comes from Coco from Miami. The question is it weird to take your shoes off on the plane?
It's weird to take your shoes off and not have on a sock.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm okay with a shoe off if you're in a sock. I can't even imagine who's going to have a barefoot on a plane.
What do you mean you can't imagine? Have you flown in America lately?
Well, I mean, I was thinking
Crocs,
of the person who
Crocs
I saw
abound.
Openly clipping their nails on a JetBlue flight.
God.
Openly clipping their nails.
Oh, my God.
I was like, are we on the L train? What are we doing? That really happened.
That sound is like the opposite of a meditation app is that snip. It's like the opposite of ASMR, the clip of a toenail. Oh, my God. But shoes, if you have socks, okay.
If you have socks, okay, not ideal, but permitted. I have a question. Okay, you're on a plane. You arrive at your destination. You enter your wherever you are, your hotel room, your house, whatever it is. How much time expires between walking through the door and Silkwood showering and getting out of what you were wearing?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I'm a pretty clean dude, but I don't rush into the shower like racked with tears thinking about what just went down in the airplane.
Really?
Yeah. I think I'm more rushing to the
on
bar.
Other chairs or like sit on other things in the place you're staying in the clothes you were just on the plane in?
When I enter a hotel room, I take off the top comforter and remove the pillows. I mean, that's table stakes.
Wait, you remove the pillows?
The top pillows, like the ones, the vanity pillows.
In the trash.
Exactly. Next to the comforter.
You'll let time go by.
I'd let time go by, sure. Like, my first concern is, like, can I just get a drink? Can I just, like, get, like, I want to get it back into life. I want to be around a friend. Like, I want to, like, be in the world again.
Into so the
mentally,
the
mental hygiene
sphere.
Is my high priority.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
This is reminding me of a couple things. I'm obsessed with this question, and many guests have answered, is on the airplane, what do you wear? Comfort or something else? What is your strategy for the airplane?
I mean, obvs, comfort, but within limits. Here's like a thinker for the ladies. Like, the most comfy thing is a jumpsuit. Like, you're kind of in a onesie, and it's very comfortable. However, if you're in a jumpsuit when you go to the bathroom, you're in a tits out pee, which just doesn't feel great.
Like, you really are vulnerable.
You're vulnerable in that tits out pee, but you're trading that off for being in like your comfiest outfit, so it's tough.
But then would you burn that outfit upon arrival?
I'm not wearing it again, no. No, I can't be clearer. Wow. I'm not repeating the clothes that touch the seat of the plane.
Wow. I believe strongly in like a good sports coat.
Are you dressing up for air travel like we're in the 60s?
A little bit. Because it's so dehumanizing to go through TSA and to wait for 5 hours to get, a bagel with egg salad and iceberg lettuce or whatever for $20, that I feel like looking kind of like dialed in makes me feel calmer.
You know what? I want to address what you're saying because it's very valid. When I say I'm dressing for comfort, I'm not doing like, like a juicy sweatsuit where yeah. you're just like, fuck you, everyone.
Yeah. I'm clipping my nails, wearing my slippers.
Fuck you. I don't want to look like I've fully given up.
I think that's the line. But on the blazer, on the sports coat,
yeah.
I do feel like it has protective powers. Like, I don't care if it wrinkles. Like, I beat it to hell. I use the pockets. I throw my passport in it. And for me, that feels a little bit like armor. And then when I am at the hotel or if I go out to dinner afterwards, I'll, like, take it off. And I feel like it kind of, like, that's kind of what protects my situation,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Inner pocket looks so great with the passport in it. People love it.
You know,
TSA loves
that
it.
That is nice. A man with a sports coat with that inner pass, that is kind of a hot moment.
Yeah, with the ticket peeking out.
Yeah, that's a sophisticated man. I have a jacket that I bought as my production jacket. It has six pockets on this jacket. It's like a utility.
Yeah.
And I bought it for set because it was like a headset pocket, a Purell pocket, your mask pocket, your phone pocket. But for travel, it's also just like all this shit. I've got my board.
Completely.
So many pockets. Now, again.
This is why Robert Altman wore one, and this is why Romancing the Stone Michael Douglas wore one. Like, all those pockets needed
pockets.
In both those scenarios. But you have your hand sani, you have your passport,
your ticket, your gum.
Yeah, and if you're in one of those uncomfortable situations where sometimes I put myself in where I'm like, I just jump in the seat because I feel like, I don't know, when I'm getting into the plane itself, a lot of anxiety, a lot of people angry, a lot of people throwing suitcases up.
It's tough out there.
And so I just want to get in there. I like knowing that if I just have to hop in the seat, it's all in my pockets. I'm all good.
It's all in your pockets.
Take care of, so.
Is there a better feeling in this world than that moment where you've made it to your seat and you butt down and you bag up and you're just like, I'm in the seat.
There is a better
There should be
feeling.
A German
there
word.
There is a better feeling. There is a better
the
feeling.
The arrival, the
when
landing.
When the doors close. And there's no one sitting next to you. And
you're
like,
yes.
Oh,
yes. The suspense.
Delicious.
The suspense of
delicious.
That empty seat.
And then you widen till takeoff so no one will get any ideas. And then you're in easy street after that.
Yeah, you got to wait till that takeoff, too. That's true. Yeah, that's a really good feeling, too.
Jesse, thank you so much for coming by and sharing your travel secrets.
This was so fun. Thank you.
That was Jesse Klein. Her latest book is called I'll Show Myself Out, Essays on Midlife and Motherhood. It's kind of like Eat, Pray, Love, but she's married, has children, and doesn't really go anywhere. So that's it for this edition of Not Lost Chat. If you have travel questions that you want answered in a future episode, you can email them to me at notlost@pushkin.fm or ping me at bfnoonim on Twitter. Please send them along. Not Lost Chat is produced by Jordan Bailey, who flew from the Bahamas to L.A. to be able to help assemble this episode. I hope Jordan allows me into the Platinum Club Centurion Lounge if we ever travel together. The show is written and hosted by me, Brendan Francis Noonan. True story, I recently rented an Airbnb in Montreal for the holiday break, but I was too busy to make the trip, didn't cancel in time, so I had to pay in full, but I did get a good review from the host. She said, I left the house in good shape. So there you go. Someone who is much better at making plans and keeping them is Laura Morgan, who helps book our show. This episode was edited by Sarah Nix with assistance from the chillest managing producer in the game, Jacob Smith. Our mix engineer, who also provides additional production support, is Sarah Bruguer. Not Lost is a co-production of Pushkin Industries, Topic Studios, and iHeartMedia. Was developed at Topic Studios. And yes, this show has some executive producers, including me, Brendan Francis Noonan, Christy Gressman, Maria Zuckerman, Lisa Langang, and Latal Malad. As always, if you dig what you hear, please tell a friend, tell the seatmate on your airplane if they look like they want to talk with you. You can also make a comment at Apple Podcasts. Spread the word. It's all really appreciated. And if your inbox is lonely, and whose isn't, you can sign up for the Pushkin newsletter at pushkin.fm/newsletter. And if you want to listen to back episodes of Not Lost or other Pushkin podcasts, then there's some great ones, Story of the Week, Slight Change of Plans. You can listen and find them on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your podcast. That is it for this episode. Thank you, everybody. Bon voyage.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.